This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for tuning in to WNRN. This is the Sunday morning wake-up call with Weezer. I got the wheezing breath, the wheezing lungs this morning. Rick Moore with our guest today, Professor Ed Murphy. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing quite well, other than the wheezing. I'm not sure what brought that on, and I'll try and... Is that something that space brings on, the discussion of space?
You know, that's actually a really interesting question. So we know today, no, that that's not true. But for the longest time, people thought comets caused the flu. And it was the influence of comets that caused influenza. And people believe that that comets brought evil spirits to Earth or evil things to Earth that caused all kinds of illness and sickness and death. And that's why for most of human history, people have feared comets.
Well, hey, bringing on the sharp questions right away. Our guest today, Professor Ed Murphy, we are going to be talking about comets throughout the day. Those of us listening on 91.9 as well as in Harrisonburg's 95.1. You know, our title today's show, we always have to think of a sharp title when you send in the guest name and the topic so they can promote the show throughout the week. And I'm like, space, still the final frontier? Is it? Because, you know, sort of a joke on from Star Trek, is space still the final frontier? Because oceanographers and maybe even geologists, if you want to go all the way to the core, might argue with you.
Ultimately, I would argue that it is the final frontier and will always be the final frontier if for no other reason than space is so vast and we have explored such a tiny fraction of what's out there that as little as we've explored of the oceans or as little as we've explored about the center of the Earth, there's far, far more out there in space that we haven't yet even touched.
All right, so our guest today, Ed Murphy, UVA professor of astronomy. He's worked on the Far Ultraviolet Spectroscopic Explorer. He runs the public night program at the McCormick Observatory, first and third Fridays, is that right?
Exactly right.
At the top of the hill here by the university?
It's from 7 to 9 p.m. on the first and third Fridays of every month.
And just recently, in March of 2014, honored with the UVA Alumni Association Distinguished Professor Award. Not yeah. Everybody gets that. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
That's quite a big deal.
Yes, thank you.
So, Professor Murphy here, our guest today, as we talk about space. A guest last year, and I found it so, it's just such an exciting topic, and you're such a wonderful talker about it. You make me so lost in my words. Anyway, we'll be talking about it. Let's just jump right in. You already made mention of comets, and that's been in the news recently, the Rosetta mission. So how does anybody even come up with the idea of landing a device on a comet? How was that received when somebody said, oh, I wonder if we can put something on a comet and learn more about comets?
You know, it's one of those things in space exploration where people dream up these wonderful things we could do. And the Rosetta mission was designed well over 10 years ago. In fact, it was launched 10 years ago, so it was designed probably close to 20 years ago now. And back then, it must have just seemed like an absolutely crazy idea to do this. But it's also essential if we want to learn about comets, how they're put together. We believe comets are the fundamental building blocks of our solar system. We think that almost everything in the solar system started out as these cold, icy bodies that would collide and stick together to make bigger bodies, that would collide with more to stick together and make even larger bodies. So we're looking here at the very basic things that built the solar system. Now, there's been a lot of change since then, for example, on the Earth. But if we want to go back to the very beginning and see what it was like at the start, comets are probably some of the best fossils from that era.
But how do you make it happen? I mean, I can understand the concept of ooh, wouldn't that be cool to try? And why we should think about making it happen, because we think that comets are would have essential information. But how does someone come up with the method to make it work? I mean, let's throw a dart at a moving rock. Seems quite difficult.
It's extraordinarily difficult, and it's an amazing accomplishment that we were able to do it. But at the same time, it's also a great time to reflect on just the amazing things that humans have been able to do in our solar system through our robotic exploration of space. So the first thing is, the way you get a mission like this funded is usually, in this case, it was a European Space Agency mission, and NASA has a few instruments that were on board. NASA has large missions like this, for example, the rovers on Mars. And the way they get funded is NASA puts out a call for missions. And they say, we're interested in funding some missions. Send us your ideas. And scientists and engineers get together, and they design all these fantastic missions. And many of us wish we could fund all of them, but that's usually not possible. So NASA has to pick one or two of these missions, and they weigh the scientific returns, what are we going to learn from the mission, against the cost of the mission. And they also consider the technical difficulty of it. Is this really possible, or are they just dreaming here? And what's the likelihood that they'll succeed? And NASA puts all these together, and they sit down and they study all the proposals, and they'll pick one or two for additional study. And then generally in the end, they'll fund one of these. And once it gets funded, that's when all the hard work begins, is that now you have to hire the engineers to make it happen. You have to hire the engineers both to design and build the spacecraft. The scientists have to now go out and look at the instruments and decide precisely what information we want to get back and how we'll use that information. The mission planners have to look at possible orbits for these things. What date will they have to launch? What date might they rendezvous with the comet? There's all kinds of people. The Rosetta mission, for example, has had well over 2,000 people involved in building, constructing, launching, and operating that spacecraft.
Now, this particular comet, and I'll never get the full name, but I see that it's called Comet 67P. What's the rest of it?
So it's two Russians who first discovered the comet. Churyumov, Gerasimenko are the two Russians. And so most people just call it 67CP because no one likes to pronounce the Russian names.
So we're talking about with Ed Murphy today, professor of astronomy, Professor Murphy here, talking about space and the Rosetta mission. So we're talking about throwing a dart at a rock. And what I found most fascinating is we make this happen. We get the dart on the rock, and most people initially hear that things don't quite work out, right?
Yes.
That it bounces a little bit, and we're not sure exactly what happens. Talk Yep. about that for a moment.
Sure. So I'm going to go back to the throwing the dart at a rock for a second, because it's a really fascinating, it was really an amazing mission up until the landing, which was spectacular. But this was something, comets are on these big looping elliptical orbits. They're not on these nice round orbits around the sun. And their orbit is very different than the orbit of the Earth. Unfortunately, we don't have a rocket big enough to launch a spacecraft like Rosetta and get it to go directly from Earth to the comet. And more importantly, it doesn't have to just get to the comet. When it gets to the comet, it has to have the same speed and direction as the comet so that it can follow the comet for many months, is the goal now, to follow the comet for over a year and a half. So the orbit of this thing, it was launched in 2004. It had to loop through the inner solar system many times. It passed the Earth twice, and it used the gravity from the Earth to boost it to a higher orbit. It passed Mars once to do the same kind of thing. And it went on this looping orbit that took a full decade before it finally swung way far out in the solar system, out where the comet was, so that it could slowly catch up to the comet and match orbits with it. Well, one of the difficult things about this was that they were so far away from the sun that there's not enough sunlight out there to power the spacecraft, because it's powered by solar arrays. Europe made the decision long ago not to pursue nuclear power for spacecraft, to just stick with solar arrays. So it was going far enough from the sun that the solar arrays wouldn't generate enough electricity to power the computers, the cameras, and everything. So they had to do something extraordinarily risky, which was in 2011, they had to shut the spacecraft down. And all they left running on board was a little timer that said, in 3 years, we want you to wake up. And that's probably the most nerve-wracking part. I mean, people who are involved in spaceflight know that when you have a spacecraft that's up and running, you never turn it off because you never know if it'll turn on. But they had no choice in this case. So they set the timer, they turned it off, and fortunately, earlier this year, Rosetta woke up when it was about 100 million miles away from the comet. And over the next couple months, as it slowly approached the comet and closed in on the comet, and more importantly, matched orbits with the comet, we were finally, for the first time, able to go into orbit around a comet. Now, that's a major accomplishment in human spaceflight history, going into orbit around the comet. But people realized 20 years ago that if you're going to go to the trouble to get into orbit, you'd really like to land something on the surface that can directly probe what the comet is made of, to have instruments on board that'll tell you the composition of the comet. And by the way, comets are big, dirty snowballs. They're made of mostly water ice with little tiny chunks of rock and ice and dust mixed in with the water ice. But it is the same kind of frozen water ice we'll have outside here in a couple months.
Now, is that true? I thought I make sure that I'm talking about the same thing. Nope. I'm going to mix up. Am I mixing up my dirty water? Oh, found water vapor significantly different to that on Earth.
Yes.
So let's keep talking. You said that it's the same water.
It's the same water that we have on Earth.
But I have a note here that was recently discovered just a few days ago, that they found that the water vapor on Comet 67P on C67P was significantly different from that of the water on Earth. So how is water, which everyone knows to be H2O, different in one place than another?
It's actually the first great discovery that has come out of the Rosetta mission, other than all the obvious pictures and things. People have wondered for a long time where the water on Earth came from. So the water on Earth, the two possible ideas that have been put forth, one is that maybe it came out of the Earth itself. The Earth very early on was very hot. The surface was bombarded by billions of meteors hitting the surface. It heated the surface of the Earth up so hot that water couldn't exist as a liquid. So sometime after the surface of the Earth cooled off, we had to bring that water in. One of the ideas that's been put forth is that water came out of the Earth itself. That water was dissolved in the molten rock underneath the ground, and we know that's true today because volcanoes today release a tremendous amount of water vapor into the atmosphere. So maybe the water on the surface was outgassed, is the term. It came out of these volcanoes and repopulated the surface of the Earth with all this liquid water. Another idea was that over time, comets and asteroids bombarding the Earth, they were very water-rich, and maybe after the crust of the Earth had cooled, they brought the water back. So there have been these two competing ideas. Did it come from the Earth itself, or did comets and asteroids bring this back in? Water and anything that contains hydrogen, there's two different kinds of hydrogen. The most common kind that we think of has a single proton in the center of it. There are three basic building blocks of atoms: protons, neutrons, and electrons. Protons and neutrons make up the center, the nucleus of an atom. And the electrons are the little negatively charged things orbiting around the outside. Hydrogen comes in two common forms. There's regular hydrogen, which has a single proton in the center, and heavy hydrogen, called deuterium, which has a single proton and a single neutron. And here on Earth, we can measure the amount of deuterium relative to normal hydrogen. It's in the water that's you and me, for example. We can measure the relative difference between those. And then we can go out and look at something like comets and see if the ratio of this heavy hydrogen to normal hydrogen is the same as it is here on Earth. And if it's the same, then it's possible that the water on Earth came from comets like this. If it's different, it means that the water on Earth probably didn't come from comets like this. And what they discovered in Comet 67CP is that the water on the comet has a different ratio of heavy hydrogen to light hydrogen, a ratio that's very different than what we have here on Earth. And so their first result is, it's not likely that a significant amount of water on the surface of the Earth came from comets like this particular comet.
Now, you're talking about how the Rosetta... So the Rosetta is the actual device that's orbiting the comet.
Yes.
And it released something, the Philae, is that the proper
that's
pronunciation?
Right, exactly, yep.
The Philae is the item, is the device that was released and is now on the comet.
That's right.
Okay. So Rosetta is now orbiting the comet, and the comet is getting closer to the sun at some point.
Yes, the August of 2015 is when it's supposed to be closest to the sun.
So can Rosetta withstand the heat as it gets around the sun?
Yes, and so Rosetta, this comet approaches no closer to the sun than the Earth gets to the sun. So the Rosetta spacecraft was designed to survive those kinds of conditions in space. But what's really interesting is it picked up, it reached the comet when the comet was about three times further from the sun than we are. And the whole point of the Rosetta orbiter, the big spacecraft that's in orbit around the comet, is to watch the comet as it heats up, as it falls in towards the sun. Because these dirty snowballs of ice out there, when they're far from the sun, they're so cold that the ice doesn't melt and they are just little chunks of ice and rock. But as a comet falls in towards the sun and heats up, the ice melts, it releases all the dust and rock particles that are contained in the ice, and the solar wind blows all that material out into that beautiful comet tail that we see up there in the night sky. And so the goal for Rosetta is to follow the comet from when it is just a chunk of ice and rock and watch it as it falls in towards the sun and it heats up and it becomes active. There are lots of questions they want to answer. For example, does the whole surface of the comet heat up and become active? Or are there just little spots here and there that become active? We have lots of evidence from ground-based missions that it's just little spots here and there called jets of material that heat up enough that they release gas, they release little tiny particles of rock and dust into space. So Rosetta is going to watch the comet and see which areas light up like that. Why is it those areas that light up? What happens to the material as it's released? What kinds of materials are released? There's all these questions that we've never seen a comet up close for a long period of time like this.
What's the expected life of Rosetta?
So Rosetta is designed to stay in orbit around the comet for 18 months. So it's going to follow it until August of next summer when the comet is closest to the sun. And at that point, they may have enough fuel left on board that they could extend the mission for a while and watch the comet as it comes a little bit out. But the end of the mission will ultimately be when the spacecraft runs out of fuel.
But Voyager, right, and
yes,
several other devices have lived far beyond their expected life.
That's
is this just because of fuel that is expected to die?
Yes, and so it depends on what you're doing. So the Voyager spacecraft, they're like a baseball. We literally threw them off the Earth, and we're letting them fly through space. And because they're not actively monitoring anything right now, they're expending very little fuel. But to stay in orbit around a comet requires constantly firing your thrusters. A comet is a very uneven body. In fact, one of the great surprises about this particular comet was when they first planned to visit this comet, it was believed to be a roughly round ball of ice and rock. And they got there, and it turns out it looks nothing like that at all. The best analogy I've heard is it looks like a rubber duck. There's a big part on the bottom and a small part attached to it with a little tiny neck in between. And so they have to expend fuel in order to stay in orbit around this thing because they're constantly changing the orbit for science purposes.
That's our guest today, Professor Ed Murphy. He's the professor at UVA's Department of Astronomy, talking about space and the... Is space still the final frontier? Starting off with the Rosetta mission, heading and covering Comet 67P, which is 67P and the Russian names?
Shuryumov Gerasimenko.
I'm not even going to try that. Thank you. Thank you for doing the official part. We'll be right back and start talking about the Kepler mission and several other topics.
WNRN thanks the following for their support of independent music radio. Valley Volkswagen, Stanton's employee-owned Volkswagen dealership. The new Volkswagen Jetta can come with a clean diesel engine and 795 miles to the tank. Valley Volkswagen deals in new and used VW vehicles. You can browse their current selection with live online support at myvalleyvw.com.
The Valentine, celebrating the completion of a multi-million dollar renovation with This is Richmond, Virginia, a new exhibition featuring the diverse stories that tell the history of this important region. Information
C&N Printing, serving Virginia since 1982. In addition to printing and copying, T&N specializes in construction document management, as well as dry mounting, binding, and mail services. T&N offers FSC-certified printing. T&N Printing can be reached at t-nprinting.com.
This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And here we are today talking about space with one of my favorite guests, Professor Ed Murphy from UVA's Department of Astronomy. I found last year's show so exciting and interesting, and with so many current events from 2014, had to have Professor Murphy back. And, you know, let's go back and finish up with some of the issues with the Rosetta mission. I didn't let you talk about what happened with the Philae device as it landed on the comet.
So Philae is about the size of, to let people picture it, it's about the size of a washing machine. Now, keep in mind that this comet is many miles across. In fact, I think a really good analogy for the size of the comet is it's about the size of Charlottesville, roughly. And so the Philae lander was quite small compared to the size of the comet. And the goal for this thing was that the spacecraft would change its orbit so that it was aimed literally on a collision course with the comet. It would release the lander, and then the spacecraft would change its orbit so that it didn't collide with the comet. And the Philae lander, which was now its own spacecraft, would touch down gently on the surface. The problem with comets are they don't have very much gravity at all. Their gravity is so weak that if you or I were standing on the surface and we had a baseball in our hand, we could just lightly toss the baseball, and that would be fast enough that the baseball would escape from the comet. There's so little gravity at all that you and I could just do a deep knee bend and push off, and we could escape from the surface. So you have to be very careful when you're landing on the surface of a comet. It's not like landing on Mars where the gravity is going to pull you down. In this case, the gravity will gently pull you down, but if you're not going slow enough or if you don't have some way to attach yourself to the surface, you'll just bounce right off, and you may bounce off so fast that you don't come back. So they had three devices on board the Philae lander for making sure that when it hit the surface of the comet, it would stick. The first one was a thruster. It would fire this thruster, which would actually push the lander down on the surface. The second one was two harpoons that would fire down into the surface with cables attached. And when those harpoons dug into the ice, they would wind in the cables. And then the last one was there were three landing legs on this device that had little ice screws. They would screw in the ice screws so that it would stay attached to the surface. One of the things about space exploration, if you're not doing things that are risky, you're not advancing humans, in my opinion. The goal of going out and doing these things that have never been done before is that you're always taking a chance that something's not going to work right. If you're operating in a place where it's so safe that you're so confident it'll work, which is, in my opinion, where you have to be when humans are involved, but the beauty of involving robots is you can do these really risky things, is that sometimes not everything works. And in this case, not everything worked well. The lander touched the surface, but the thruster didn't fire. And they had indications earlier in the day that the thruster wasn't working properly. Remember, this spacecraft had been in orbit around the sun for 10 years and had spent 3 years in deep hibernation. So in that time, something had happened to the thruster that it wasn't going to work. They sent the signal to fire the harpoons, and for some reason, the harpoons didn't fire. And over time, the European Space Agency will try and figure out why both of those things happened. But they don't know right now what happened. So the lander hits the surface, the thruster doesn't fire, the harpoons don't fire, so it bounces right off the surface. and it bounced off the surface with almost enough speed to escape from the comet, but it didn't, and it bounced for 2 hours. It slowly rose to about 3,000 feet above the surface of the comet, and then slowly gravity pulled it back down to the surface.
3,000 feet?
3,000 feet above the surface. And at the time that it hit the surface, it was traveling about a mile per hour. And even colliding with the surface of the comet at a mile per hour, it bounced 3,000 feet in the air. That's how weak the gravity of a comet is. So it bounces high into the air, comes back down, bounces a second time, and finally settles down on the surface of the comet. The lander has panoramic cameras that can take pictures in every direction. And what they've determined is that it is sitting on a tilt up against a wall. So one of the pictures returned a close-up photograph of the wall, which I think is going to go down in history as one of the most spectacular pictures ever returned from space, because we've never seen the material of a comet up close like that. And here, just literally feet away from the lander, is this icy wall that's made up of, we don't even know yet exactly, but it looks like little chunks of rock, chunks of ice, chunks of dust, and you can actually see it up close. The biggest problem for the lander is it had solar cells on board. And the solar cells were designed to recharge a battery on board. And in order to recharge that battery, to keep the lander running, they needed about 6 hours of sunlight every day. And the original landing spot they had picked had 6 hours of sunlight every day. Well, when it ended up against this cliff, now it's getting about an hour of good sunlight every day. And that's not enough to recharge the batteries. So after a couple days, the batteries went dead. The primary battery went dead. And we haven't heard from the spacecraft since. Rosetta, the orbiter, is still working beautifully. And Rosetta is frantically photographing the surface of the comet to try and find where the lander ended up. And even now, a month later, they still have yet to find where the lander is on the surface of the comet. They have a pretty good idea of where it ended up, but they'd really like to see a picture of it sitting there on the surface.
Wow. So fascinating. We are talking with our guest today, Professor Ed Murphy from UVA's Department of Astronomy. Honored with UVA's Alumni Association Distinguished Professor Award in March of 2014. Professor, one of the things that I found so engaging to listen to you talk about last year, do the cosmic calendar to help people understand where we are in the length of, just talk about that to help people understand life.
Absolutely. So the universe is 13.8 billion years old. And it's hard to get that concept across to people. It's even hard for astronomers and scientists to understand a period of time that is as vast as 13.8 billion years. And so Carl Sagan was the first one to come up with an idea of trying to convert that 13.8 billion years into a period of time that most people can understand. And he said, what if we compressed it into a single year? That is, we take the 13.8 billion years. Our universe began with the Big Bang. So we put the Big Bang on January 1st of the year at midnight. And then the present day is at December 31st at 11:59:59, you know, fraction of a second before midnight. So we compress the history of the universe into one calendar year. And that's a time period that you and I can understand. So then Carl Sagan figured out when various things happen. So, for example, the Big Bang happened. Oh, and one thing about the cosmic calendar to keep in mind is that there are 13.8 billion years in the history of the universe, and our calendar contains 12 months. So a single month is a little over a billion years in the history of the universe. So let's talk about some of the major events that happen. The Big Bang happens on January 1st at midnight, the origin of our universe. Our Milky Way galaxy, the vast cloud of gas and dust and hundreds of billions of stars, our Milky Way galaxy finishes forming in late February or early March on the cosmic calendar. It's important to keep in mind that the Big Bang was not the origin of our sun and Earth and the planets in our solar system. They came along much, much later. And in fact, the Milky Way finishes forming in early March, and stars are born, live out their lives, and die. A star like our sun lives for 10 billion years, which is about 9 months on the cosmic calendar. Massive stars, really massive stars, only live for a couple days on the cosmic calendar. And then there's some really massive stars that only live for a couple hours on the cosmic calendar. So the galaxy forms in March. And all through March and April and May and June and July and August, stars are being born, living out their lives, and dying. And more stars are being born, living out their lives, and dying. And stars are constantly in the process of being born, living out their lives, and dying. Finally, in September, the Earth forms. Our solar system forms. So the Big Bang happens on January 1st. Our solar system doesn't come into existence until early September on the cosmic calendar. That's when our sun and the Earth and all the planets in our solar system form.
So that's 9 months.
That's
pretty
nine
close.
Months. And we're well into the history of the universe. The Earth and the sun and our solar system didn't form with the Big Bang. There were many generations of stars before our sun was born. And in fact, one of the most amazing things that come out of that is the stuff that you and I are made of. The carbon, the nitrogen, the oxygen in our bodies wasn't made in the Big Bang. It was made in those previous generations of stars. You and I are made of stuff that was born in those early generations of stars. So the Earth forms in early September. The first evidence that we have of life on Earth comes about very quickly. By the middle of September, there are simple single-cell life forms on Earth. And so we have very good evidence by that early time, not long after the Earth formed, that life had already taken hold on Earth. But this was simple life. And then the next most amazing fact about it is simple life dominates the Earth in September, October, November, and the first half of December. For billions of years, the Earth has nothing on it but simple, single-celled organisms. And it isn't until the middle of December that we get the first complex animals.
When you say single life, you're talking about stink bugs, right? Because that's what dominates my house.
That's right. No, stink bugs are complex life. But by simple life, I'm talking about literally pond scum. The kind of stuff you go out to a pond and you see the green algae on the pond. That kind of simple life. Nothing nearly as complex or as interesting as a stink bug. They didn't come around until bugs, insects, the first animals, were middle of December on the cosmic calendar. So the Big Bang happens in January. Lots of stars are being born and died. The sun comes around in early September. The Earth has its first life by the middle of September. And then for the next few months, it's nothing but simple, single-celled life on Earth until the middle of December, when animals arise for the very first time. To tell you how old the universe is, or how short a period of time human beings are, is the dinosaurs show up around Christmas Day on the calendar. That's when the dinosaurs first show up on the calendar. And the dinosaurs last an amazing amount of time. The dinosaurs last for four whole days on the cosmic calendar. They come late on the 25th, early on the 26th of December, and they last through the 27th, 28th, 29th, and the dinosaurs went extinct on the 30th of December. Now remember, that was 65 million years ago, and that's the 30th of December. And we think of the dinosaurs as being a long time ago, and yet in the cosmic calendar, it's the day before the last day of the year. Humans, the first modern humans, show up just a couple minutes before midnight on the very last day of the year. Some of the things that we think of as ancient developments in human history, such as agriculture, the development of agriculture was about 22 seconds before midnight. All of that we think of human history, recorded human history, happens in the last few seconds before midnight. And to put it all in perspective, Galileo and Kepler and Copernicus were the first ones to show us that the Earth was orbiting the sun and not the other way around. And that happens 1 second before midnight. That was 400 years ago. A human lifespan is less than a quarter second on the cosmic calendar. So if you take the history of the universe as a year, a human lifespan is less than a quarter second.
It's even that, to simplify it in that sense, to allow me to get my grasp of it, still makes it difficult to get your grasp around it. Because Because even that, you go, really? No, that can't be possible. Yet it is.
Yeah.
University of Virginia professor Ed Murphy, professor of astronomy. We'll be right back.
Support today for WNRN comes from
Commonwealth Reserve, Commonwealth Skybar's new private event space. From food and bar menus to floor plans, every detail is customizable. Commonwealth Reserve for business meetings, presentations, receptions, luncheons, and dinners. Commonwealth Reserve's event planner can tailor events from 20 to 100 guests. You can book your event at CommonwealthReserve.com.
Virginia Vinegar Works in Nelson County, makers of Star Hill malt vinegar, red and white wine vinegars, and small batch fruit vinegars. Virginia Vinegar Works vinegar adds new flavor to your holiday meals and is the gift for your chef or foodie friends this holiday season. VirginiaVinegarWorks.com.
The Markets of Tiger Fuel Company. Homegrown since 1982, you can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street.
Hello, I'm Audrey Hawkins from the Brockbridge Christmas Basket Program. Since 1949, our nonprofit organization has delivered Christmas cheer and goodwill to needy families in Lexington, Brockbridge County, and Buena Vista. Every year, we serve over 1,000 families with food and toys to ensure everyone has a happy holiday season. We are looking for volunteers to assist us to pack boxes of food and bags of toys and to help clean up afterwards. Packing day is scheduled for Saturday, December 20th from 8 a.m. until noon at the Howard P. Anderson Arena at the Virginia Horse Center. Everyone is invited to participate. We are also looking for financial donations to fund our project. For more information, you can write to us, rockbridgechristmasbasket@gmail.com. I'm Audrey Hawkins, making a community connection on WNRN.
Make your community connection with WNRN. Email connection@WNRN.org with your nonprofit event or organization's information. Independent Music Radio, WNRN.
This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thanks for being here with us today. My guest, Professor Ed Murphy from University of Virginia's Department of Astronomy, talking about all kinds of things space-related. Professor, let's talk about the Kepler mission. There's all kinds of things going on in the world of space from 2014 and not too far in the past leading up to what's happening in 2014, like the Kepler mission. Share that with us.
So we were talking earlier about comets and how they were the basic building blocks of our solar system. And one of the deep questions that astronomers would love to know the answer to is how common are Earth-like planets going around sun-like stars? Because ultimately, we think the conditions for life require liquid water. All life on Earth requires liquid water. And so if we're going to find a planet out there that might have life on it someday, and just so to lay the groundwork for this right away is to say that we don't have the technology right now to look for life on other worlds. That's a technology that our children, our great-grandchildren are going to have to develop. All we can do right now is try and find Earth-sized planets that are in the right orbits around their stars that they might have liquid water on the surface. And that was the primary goal of the Kepler mission. If I were giving this interview about 20 years ago, I would have had to say that astronomers don't know of any planets going around any other star. We think planets are common, but we don't know of any planets other than the 9 planets going around our sun. 9, because Pluto was still a planet back then. But about 20 years ago, astronomers first developed the techniques for finding planets around sun-like stars. And since that time, we have now discovered thousands of stars that have planetary systems. And the Kepler mission alone has discovered about 3,000 candidate planets going around stars. 1,000 of those have been confirmed. And astronomy has taken this revolution from 20 years ago saying, well, we think planets are common, to today being able to demonstrate conclusively that, yes, planets are extraordinarily common. And it seems very likely that many stars, if not most stars, if not nearly all stars, have planets going around them.
So I'm just fascinated by this because the goal is to identify planets that may fall into categories similar to Earth, correct?
Yes.
But how do you do that? I mean, we send out this device that can, or we're not even sending out a device.
That's right.
What it is, it's a telescope, correct?
Yes, exactly right.
That is looking out into the sky saying, oh, there's a star there. And if I look close enough, I can identify a planet that appears to be an appropriate distance away.
You know, it's even harder than that because it turns out that trying to see a planet around a star is like trying to find a firefly, a little lightning bug, that's flying around a searchlight when the searchlight is aimed right at your face. So the planets are so faint and the stars are so bright that the way we actually, the way Kepler discovers planets is as the planet orbits around the sun. If the orbit of the planet is tilted just right, it passes right in front of its star. And as the planet passes in front of the star, it blocks a little bit of light from the star for a few hours as the planet crosses in front of the star. And then when the planet moves off the front of the star returns back to its normal brightness. So what Kepler does is it used to stare at a single field in the northern sky. It's actually visible in the summertime near the constellations of Lyra the Harp and Cygnus the Swan. It stared at this single field 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. And every few minutes, it measured the brightness of 150,000 stars in that field of view. And it sent that data down to Earth. And what the astronomers would look for is if you watch the stars, stars are remarkably constant in their brightness when you look at them from space. Down here on Earth, when we look at them, we see stars twinkling all the time. Turns out twinkling is not an inherent property of the stars. Stars themselves don't twinkle. That's what happens to their light when it passes through the Earth's atmosphere. As that light passes through our atmosphere, it gets bent back and forth and back and forth by the atmosphere, and that causes the star to get brighter and dimmer and sometimes blink completely off and blink on. And so we couldn't do this kind of experiment from Earth. We had to get the telescope outside of our atmosphere where we can truly see the stars as steady as they really are. And so Kepler stared at these 150,000 stars, measuring their brightness every few minutes and sending that data back to Earth. And every now and then we would see one of these stars dim out for a few hours and then it would recover after the planet had passed in front of the star. And you can't be sure whether that's a planet or not. Could be a sunspot, could be lots of different things. So what you have to do is you have to wait till that planet orbits all the way around the star and comes back again. Well, now you've seen it go in front of the star twice. That prediction tells you how long it takes the planet to go around the star. And with that, you can do two things. From the law of gravity, you can figure out how far the planet is from the star. But you can also then wait for the third eclipse, because if it, say, take the Earth, for example, the Earth would pass in front of the sun now. It would do it a year later. And then that second one, you should say, well, it takes an Earth year to orbit the sun. So it should happen exactly 1 year later. And if you see that third one, then you're quite confident you have a planet. So Kepler was designed to spend many, many years looking for planets and has been an outstanding success. And what we've learned from it is that it has discovered thousands of potential planetary systems. It's been able to confirm 1,000 planets going around other stars. And we believe now that planetary systems are not only common, but we believe that Earth-sized planets in habitable zones, that is the zone around the star where the temperature is just right for liquid water, that those kinds of stars, those kinds of planets might be common in the galaxy.
Professor Ed Murphy with us today talking about various topics on space, the Kepler mission. I failed to give out the phone number. I saw the phone ringing a minute ago, and my failure, 434-979-0919. Try back my failure again, 434-979-0919. If you have a question or a comment for Professor Murphy. So how much has the growth of computers changed the way that astronomy works? I mean, the vision is of a gentleman in a lab coat or a female in a lab coat looking up through the telescope doing the work.
Yes, and it couldn't be further from the truth these days. So first of all, neither I nor my colleagues ever wear lab coats. So lab coats are what are worn by scientists who are in what people traditionally think of a laboratory with test tubes but physical scientists like astronomers, we don't work in labs like that, so we don't wear lab coats. But the other thing is computers have absolutely revolutionized everything we do in the field of astronomy. So this picture that we have of astronomers sitting there looking through a telescope, that's what we did 120 years ago. But starting about 100 years ago, astronomers stopped looking through telescopes and started photographing things. The new technology of photography had finally gotten developed enough. It had finally gotten advanced enough that we could take pictures of the stars on glass photographic plates and preserve those images. And that had a tremendous advantage. So first of all, these photographs, these photographic plates were more sensitive to light than the human eye. And we could let the light build up on the photographic plate, so you could take an exposure that was many seconds or minutes long. And then the third advantage of these are is they make a permanent record of what happened, and so you can share that with other people. And photography dominated astronomy from about the early 1900s up until the 1990s, when we abandoned photography in favor of digital photography, and everything is done digitally today.
There's a question from Brenda about whether or not sensible lighting has changed the way we can view the stars.
I wish I could say that sensible lighting would help, and in particular, full cutoff lighting would be a tremendous boon to astronomy. I'm afraid to say, though, that the vast, vast majority of lighting that is installed is not sensible, and it has significantly made astronomers' jobs more difficult. So to back up on this for a second, light pollution is a big problem in astronomy. Light pollution is all those nighttime lights that are shining up into the sky. Astronomers are not against lights at night. We absolutely understand that they're necessary. What we would like to see are lights that put all their light down onto the ground where it's needed. When you're driving at night, you need the light down on the ground. You don't need the light shining up into the sky, making the sky brighter. But unfortunately, sensible lighting that puts the light down on the ground is not something that we as a society have decided to widely adopt. Astronomers push for it, but it has not been adopted in the vast majority of cases. And so we have the situation today where children grow up in urban areas and they think the night sky contains a dozen stars, and they never see the Milky Way and they never see the glory of the night sky like people who live out in the country still can. And this means that for astronomers, we've had to get as far away from city lights as we can. But even in those cases, you still see the impacts of light pollution, and it's getting to be very difficult.
Professor Murphy with us today talking about astronomy. Dewey, are you with us?
Yes, I am, Rick.
Hey, thanks for calling. Question for Professor Murphy.
This just totally fascinates me, and it's much far over my head, but I mean, from the Milky Way, which I see, I live in Louisa, and I've shown people it, and they think it's just clouds, and I'm like, no, it's not clouds, it's a cluster of, but anyway, my comment was to the professor, when my dad and I watched the original Cosmos series, which went on, I think, a week, if not more, it was with Carl Sagan, his calendar, he separated in each day into years, which you, Professor, did not do. Each day of the calendar, if I can remember correctly, this has been many years ago, the last day was a little teeny dot up in the corner of the very last day of the month that we as humans began and up until this point. Another question, real quick. We're heading into December, the religious month. How does he try to convince the religious folks on the timeline of this earth? Thank you, Rick. I'm going to turn my volume up.
All right, Dewey. Thanks, man.
So there were a couple things in there. One is Carl Sagan has in his book on the Cosmos series, his famous book called Dragons of Eden, he lays out the cosmic calendar, and then Neil deGrasse Tyson just did that again as part of his remake of the original Cosmos series. And you can find a lot more detail about what goes on every day. I was trying to shorten it here today so that we didn't spend the whole hour talking about every important event. But you're right that all of recorded human history is in the last few seconds of the last day of that calendar. And what we think of modern history, so for example, the last 100 years where we have aircraft and we have, or even the last 50 years where we have computers, that ends up being a fraction of a second right before midnight at the end of the day. As for the other question about the relationship between science and religion, which is scientists work on making observations of the universe, and we draw inferences from those observations. And science works beautifully in the sense that we have to, everything we say in science, we have to back up with evidence. And religion is very differently. Religion is based on faith. Science is based on provable evidence, observations. And those two realms to me are separate. A famous biologist by the name of Stephen Jay Gould had pointed out that they're separate realms, magisterial realms is what he called them. And scientists, when they operate as a scientist, we have to demand the evidence. And when people are religious, and there certainly are religious scientists, they operate instead on faith. They don't demand evidence that God exists. They believe that God exists regardless of evidence. Scientists operate in a different realm. So I can lay out the evidence for people. People have to examine that evidence. It is up to them to look at that evidence and make a decision for themselves. That said, I have to point out that when we look at the world around us, I mean, look at everything around you. You're probably sitting someplace in an automobile or you have a digital device on you. Science and this evidence-based world has done a tremendous amount for us, none of which would be possible without the scientific method and the many different methods of science.
Thanks for the phone call, Dewey. It is 11:51 on the wake-up call. Just a few minutes left with our guest, Professor Ed Murphy from UVA's Department of Astronomy. Professor, a couple things we'll jam together here at the end of the hour, which sort of tie together. The Orion, recent flight with Orion, and the Orbital Sciences blast. Talk about those as the, I guess, sort of the future of flight here with NASA and others.
That's right. And so we saw two things recently. One is that we have in orbit around the Earth right now the International Space Station, and the International Space Station is on a continuous basis occupied by between 3 and 6 astronauts, depending on where they are in their crew rotation. And what's really amazing is that we have had people living and working continuously in space nonstop for close to 14 years now. And so that's the first time in human history that we've not only had people in space, but we've continuously had people in space for that time since the first crew went up to the International Space Station. Those people on the International Space Station need supplies. And we have in the United States, we used to bring the supplies up on the space shuttle. It was decided after the Columbia accident and 7 astronauts lost their lives that we needed to retire the space shuttle. It was too dangerous. It was very expensive. We needed something to follow on. So President Bush decided that we would build a new spacecraft to take astronauts into space, and we would build a new cargo rocket to bring cargo up. But when President Obama came into office, that program was far behind schedule and way over budget, and they realized that it just wasn't going to happen fast enough in the timescale that we needed it in order to retire the space shuttle in the schedule that had been set. And so they went a different route, which is the commercial route. They decided that for the International Space Station, which is only 240 miles above the surface of the Earth, that commercial companies should be able to provide essentially a shuttle service to get both cargo and humans to the International Space Station. So they let out contracts with a number of companies initially to provide cargo services, and here hopefully within a couple years to provide the service of launching our astronauts into orbit for us. But right now there are two main companies that are sending cargo up to the International Space Station. One is SpaceX. This is Elon Musk's company. He was one of the founders of PayPal, amongst other things, and he formed a company to get into the rocket business, and he's launching cargo up to the International Space Station. And the other one is based right here in Virginia, called Orbital Sciences. They're headquartered in Dulles, and they launch out of the eastern shore of Virginia. And they were on one of these resupply missions bringing cargo up in October, late October, when their Antares rocket had an accident. One of the engines down on the first stage, the turbo pump, failed. The engine exploded and it destroyed the rocket and the cargo that was headed for the space station. So that was very disappointing for them. They have already made announcements about how they're going to pull out of this. So the first thing is they have a spacecraft that brings cargo to the space station. They've contracted with another company called United Launch Alliance, and they're going to launch their spacecraft on somebody else's rocket while they redesign their rocket to have new engines on the first stage. And they're hoping that that rocket will fly again sometime in early 2016. SpaceX is about to launch later this week. So they were scheduled to launch on December 16th. They've delayed it to December 19th, but SpaceX is sending the next load of cargo up here at the end of the week. And hopefully that'll be a success.
Now, we don't have, I mean, that's one of the issues for extended space travel, is there's no room for error.
Oh, no, absolutely not. Yep.
I mean, people talk about going further in space. There is no room for going to Mars. I mean, and maybe we can get to Mars, but I was listening to a previous show that you did with me, and you talk about how the grandchildren of those who we send now, if you have that sort of error, you can't send someone to go help.
That's absolutely right. When we talk about the International Space Station has the advantage that being 240 miles above the surface of the Earth, when a cargo mission like this fails, it's not critical. We can launch additional cargo on the next flight, and they will make up for this with additional flights into the future. But when you head off to Mars, when you leave Earth, we can't send anything to you. And so as you take that trip to Mars, which could be 9 to 12 months to get to Mars, 9 to 12 months to get home, and anywhere from a month to a year down on the surface of Mars, that whole time, you are completely on your own with no aid provided by the Earth. And so we have to build up that kind of reliability. And that's actually the next step in NASA's program. We had just a test last week of this new Orion capsule. And the Orion capsule is NASA's next capsule to take astronauts beyond low Earth orbit, beyond the space station, because that's going to be handled by commercial companies now, but to get astronauts to the moon or to Mars or to asteroids out there. And so this has to be a very reliable spacecraft, much more reliable than we've thought about in the past. And that first test last week of Orion was just an outstanding success. It was a week ago Friday. They launched it on two looping orbits of the Earth, went up to an altitude of over 3,000 miles in order to mimic a return from a moon trip, which is much faster than they returned from the International Space Station. This was to test the heat shield, test the avionics, the electrical equipment on board, to test the parachutes, to test the whole thing beginning to end. And it was an outstanding success. So the Orion capsule was launched from Cape Canaveral. 4 hours later, it splashed down in the Pacific just off the Baja Peninsula. And it appears that that mission was just from beginning to end a complete success.
All right, I've got three questions here in 2 minutes, so let's see what we can do. Do you think that politics are going to get in the way of the International Space Station?
I believe, yes, for human spaceflight, I think the lack of funding is a significant problem. So take the Orion spacecraft, for example. We just launched on its first test. The rocket, the space launch system, won't be ready until 2018. So it's going to be 4 years before we see another test of this thing. And then the first humans are expected to fly on it in 2021, 7 years from now. In the 1960s, we went from not having a space program to landing people on the moon in 9 years. And because of the lack of funding today, we have a spacecraft that we tested, and it'll be 7 years before we can put people on it. So the lack of funding does significantly impact the rate at which NASA can operate right now.
All right. Chris called in. I hope I asked this properly. Are you familiar with the work of Wallace Thornhill and plasmology in the electric universe?
No, I'm not. Not at all.
All right. Then the last question for Professor Ed Murphy and from the UVA's Professor of Astronomy. How can Santa use astronomy to get around the world in just one night?
Yes, I've seen that report many times about how he has to travel so fast. And so I'm just going to have to chalk that one up to being faith rather than science, because according to the known laws of physics and the known laws of science, the something special has to happen on Christmas night.
We'll ask him, because next week Santa will be here for his annual visit. We'll be calling some kids to make sure that they're behaving properly and find out exactly what they want for Christmas Day. Professor Murphy, thank you so much.
Thank you
for being here. I find it fascinating to see what's going on and learn a little bit more about astronomy. And happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you.
Les Temps Perdue up next, everyone.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at wakeupcall@wnrn.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Brandon Wong
and Max Cecilia Struther.
Tune in next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.